This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast.
On TSN1290.ca.
Reach to center ice. He'll dump it in. Stopped by DeMello. And that is just about going to do it here. And the horn sounds to end the Winnipeg Jets season. The Calgary Flames will move on as they win 4-0 here tonight. And Cam Talbot records his third postseason shutout. And he does so with a convincing victory and series over the Winnipeg Jets here this evening.
Our buddy, Paul Edmonds with the call from Thursday night with a whimper and not a bang. The Winnipeg Jets season comes to an end again, just as quickly as it seemed to have begun. Good morning, Winnipeg. Good morning, Manitoba. And for all those joining us live this morning at TSN1290.ca and via the iHeartRadio app, we say good morning, universe, and welcome to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. I'm your host, Drew Mindell, joined alongside Ezra Ginsberg and Dave Minuke. And it was a disappointing end to the Winnipeg Jets season on Thursday night, guys. It's amazing that it was 7 days ago, this time last Saturday, where hope springs eternal. We were getting all geared up and excited for the Jets' opening game against the Calgary Flames in the qualification series, and it really only took about 5.5 minutes into that first period of Game 1 for the Jets' bubble to deflate, if not to altogether burst, with the injury to Mark Scheifele and then eventually a 4-game series defeat at the hands of the Calgary Flames. Good morning, Ezzy. Good morning, Dave. Good to see you both on
morning,
this Saturday
boys.
Morning.
Yeah, it's unbelievable also, guys, that we only have one series going to a fifth game, right? Like, we knew that this was going to be unpredictable, the qualifying round, right? But when you talk about only one series, of course, that being Toronto and Columbus with that unbelievable finish that I'm sure that we'll get into later, guys. But, I mean, obviously, you mentioned the Mark Scheifele injury, and the complexion of this series, guys, changed with Mark Scheifele leaving that game, the Matthew Tkachuk hit, all of that, and then, you know, the question about, you know, whether, you know, there was intent or anything like that. And obviously, I think we all agree that that was, you know, just a freak play.
Don't speak for me.
Well,
I don't necessarily agree with you, but I'll let you finish your thought and then we can get into it.
Well, the point is that there was no supplemental discipline. There was no penalty. You know, most people, I think you would agree, said that at the very least, it was something that, you know, the outcome was much worse than that the intent was, right? So I think when you're talking about this series, if you look at it at a macro level, guys, you know, the Jets don't have Mark Scheifele and Patrick Laine for 3 of the 4 games. I mean, it's really impossible to not factor that into the analysis here, because I'm sorry, I don't care what anybody says, guys, if the Jets have Scheifele and Laine, the outcome of this series, there's a good chance that it's different. Right? If you take Johnny Gaudreau and you take Matthew Tkachuk off of the Flames roster, there's a good chance that, you know, they don't win this series. But when you look at the last couple of games, obviously, I mean, the Jets lost those games pretty bad. And, you know, we should also throw in, you know, no Mason Appleton. And, you know, obviously Matthew Perreault had to leave Game 3. So, I mean, there were a lot of injuries here. But at the end of the day, guys, I mean, the Flames did outplay the Jets. Cam Talbot is that's something that we didn't talk about a lot before. Cam Talbot outplayed Connor Hellebuck. Connor Hellebuck obviously isn't the reason the Jets lost this series, but Talbot was better. I mean, it's undeniable that he was better in this series. So, I mean, it's unfortunate. We knew that a best of five, you know, anything could happen. But when you look back at it, I mean, a couple of huge injuries for the Jets, and, you know, that really was the story here. Hellebuck wasn't able to steal a game, and that's really something he had to do, Dave. When you don't have Scheifele, you don't have Laine, you know, Appleton as well, but more so Scheifele and Laine, a couple of your big guns, you needed Hellebuck to steal, you know, one of those two games, and, you know, unfortunately, he's just a man.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it was between the injuries and the special teams play that was really what did in the Jets. And I think, ultimately, if you want to talk about this series, you can't, again, like you said, Drew, the first 5.5 minutes changed the entire complexion of the series. Now, I'm with Ez. I don't necessarily think that there was intent to injure. I think Tkachuk tried to get a piece of Scheifele as he was going, but, you know, I don't think he tried to consciously injure him. It was funny because you put out what crushing was when Paul Maurice talked about what the specifics of the injuries were once the Jets had been eliminated after Game 4. And And I, too, didn't know what he was talking
about.
So for
those who missed the audio from Paul Maurice after the game on Thursday, he was asked, you know, is Scheifele's injury, was it an Achilles injury, mm-hmm. as everyone sort of was speculating that maybe he got a skate blade to the back of the
right.
leg.
He got cut.
Yeah,
I thought it was
ankle all along.
Well, whatever it was, it turned out to be a crushing injury, which, again, and when you hear crushing injury, you think it's crushing to the team,
mm-hmm.
because obviously it was. But in this case, that's sort of a medical diagnosis where...
It basically sounds like it's pressure, like extreme pressure between the skate and, I'm assuming, well, two objects, essentially.
That's right. I'm assuming almost it's hard to say what the two objects are.
Yeah.
You know, probably Kachuk's leg and maybe the boards or something.
Yeah, exactly.
When Paul Maurice said that, I got, like, visions of, like, a salvage yard or something.
It was like a vice.
Like, two cars, getting crushed together.
Yeah. The leg gets caught in a vice-like scenario there, David.
Yeah. So that was the question, was whether he had been cut or whether... But the reality was... And, you know, the big question, and it was funny because there were so many articles written by the Flames writers talking about how they're preparing as if Scheifele and Laine are going to be back in the series. Turns out, of course, that, you know, when Paul Maurice was doing his availability after game four, Laine and Appleton were 2 to 3 weeks away.
Yeah.
Appleton had a shoulder injury. Laine had a wrist injury. He had been
sprained wrist.
Yeah.
Couldn't grip the top of his stick.
It's amazing how many I don't know why you call them keyboard warriors, but I can't get over how many people write comments like play through. Like, let's be realistic, guys. It's the playoffs. If these guys could play through the injury, mm-hmm. they would play through the injury. So if they're not playing, there's a specific reason why they're not playing.
Because you can't grip the stick.
That's right. I mean, Patrick Laine, if he can't shoot, is not necessarily the effect of Patrick Laine you're going to want in a series. You know, I mean, if his leg strength isn't, you know, he blocks a shot, his leg strength isn't what it is, that's fine. He can work through that. It's a little more difficult without his ability to shoot.
Yeah.
So that was, and he was 2 to 3 weeks away. And it sounds like Scheifele was... He initially said he's in that range, but we have to get more of an assessment. So it sounds like these guys wouldn't have been available even had the Jets advanced past Calgary and into the first round.
Right, guys, and there's no way that you can break this series down without talking about Scheifele and Laine just because they're such significant players. But to me, a huge storyline, and again, I realize a lot of the focus was on Kyle Connor, right? Because, you know, he doesn't end up potting a goal. You know, mm-hmm. he had 38 goals during the regular season. You know, a lot of the focus on Blake Wheeler. But, you know, you look at the Jets goal scores. Do you guys know how many Jets goal scores there were? There were only five.
Yeah. I was going to say four, but I mean, I knew it was a low number.
Sorry, it was four, actually.
Okay.
I missed a goal there.
Kopp have two, right?
Yeah, Kopp had two, Ehlers had two, Lowry one, Harkins one. So when you're looking, you know, at the series as well, that was something that the Jets just didn't get enough goals. Mm-hmm. Like, I realize that that's some obvious analysis there, but, you know, when you're talking about Cody Eakin, he didn't have any goals. Jack Roslovic didn't have any goals, right?
Like, the Jets' best players were either out of the lineup or ineffective when they were in the lineup, and that's Wheeler and Connor. I mean, Blake Wheeler and Kyle Connor each had one assist in four games. And Kyle Connor, I think, was certainly more noticeable in my mind than Blake Wheeler was. Connor was, you know, had plenty of good opportunities that, you know, more often than not, he's probably gonna get a goal in those scenarios. He just wasn't able to do it in this series. Blake Wheeler, to me, was, you know, it's too harsh to say he was the invisible man, but he certainly was not impactful in the four games in the series.
Now, I didn't think Kyle Connor or Blake Wheeler was right during the entire series. And you know, by right, I mean, they just didn't seem like they were at the level that they needed to be in a short series. And obviously that's affected by your centerman not being there. And then obviously Blake Wheeler has to shift to center. But, you know, Kyle Connor, by the way, had six shots in game number four versus the Flames, right? So
right.
To your point, I mean, you expected Kyle Connor to have, you know, at least a couple of goals in this series, right?
Like, his expected goals were better than zero.
Sure, and I don't think he was awful. Like, I don't think, again, that it goes back to what I said before, guys. Like, this series, it's not Kyle Connor and Blake Wheeler didn't you know, cost the Jets the series because they didn't score goals. It didn't help them, but the Jets weren't getting offense from anybody. That's what I'm saying. Like, you can't win a series, you know, when you score, you know, how many goals did the Jets score?
What did the Flames have?
Five or six.
The Flames had 13 different guys who scored, I think?
It was certainly close to double. It was in double digits,
right.
If I'm not
so,
mistaken.
I mean,
right.
To Ezzie's point, you can't – I mean, look, it's a short series, so generally sometimes you can – hope that maybe one or two guys can take over it. But I think what we saw from Calgary was balance. And I think that you got the balance. You had Talbot playing a really effective game.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Andrew Berkshire actually wrote a really interesting article in the Free Press talking about some of the guys who had better than expected results, and you don't necessarily realize it. He said he talked about Wheeler, the Wheeler, Connor, and Ehlers line, and he said the play of Ehlers was certainly big. Sorry, there are a few positives to take from the series, as disheartening as it is. He said the play of Ehlers was certainly a big reason why that line was so strong, but the resurgence of Blake Wheeler after trending downward the previous few seasons continued into the playoffs. So from Berkshire's perspective, he essentially was talking about Wheeler from a defensive perspective, not from an offensive perspective, obviously, with only the one goal. But he basically talked about how that line was able to exert positive control over shot attempts, shots on net, and slot passes. So, I mean, but again, and I think a lot of people would agree, a lot of that has to do with what Nikolaj Ehlers, and talking about what a player you needed to see emerge, and, you know, as he said it before the series even began, I think his exact words were something to the effect of, you know, nobody is worried about Nikolaj Ehlers' ability to contribute and ability to play. And I think after he scored that goal, You saw the next game, he was flying. Mm-hmm. And he was absolutely...
He was like, the best Jets forward, there's no question.
Yeah, I mean, like, he was... But again, for years, I think we've been saying, like, Nikolaj Ehlers probably should be... Like, I remember when he was put on the first line, I'm like, well, Ehlers should be on the first line. For what he's able to create, for the opportunities he can create for this team. You know, again, he doesn't play the same structure necessarily as some of the other guys. But I think from a danger standpoint, mm-hmm. for a puck possession standpoint, Nikolaj Ehlers is a guy you probably want to have giving more opportunity.
Well,
to.
Throughout the entire, you know, the vast majority of the series, I thought the Jets were on their heels. That Calgary was taking the play to the Jets, that the Jets did not necessarily have any answers for Calgary's physicality, the forecheck, the way that they were able to really beat up the Jets, I thought, you know, for the majority of the series. The only player on the Jets who I thought was consistently threatening was Nikolaj Ehlers. Mm-hmm. I thought everybody else just did not look like themselves. I'm talking about the guys
top
that
six,
you rely on.
Six.
Top six, okay. The best players. I thought that, you know, the Flames' best players were better than the Jets' best players, with the exception of maybe Nikolaj Ehlers. Nikolaj Ehlers, I thought, was dangerous every time he was on the ice for the most part.
Yeah, absolutely. There's no doubt that he was the most dangerous Jet forward. And, you know, that's kind of what we expected going in. We didn't think that, you know, his goalless drought was going to continue. We kind of all agreed, you know, that we expected Ehlers to, at the very least, you know, get a goal or two, right? And when you're talking about, you know, the Jets and Flames series, I think there are positives for the Jets. I mean, Jansen Harkins, obviously, you know, we didn't know if he was going to be in this series at all, and injuries, you know, kind of thrust him into the lineup. He gets that, you know, beautiful goal on that really nice pass by Dave just mentioned. I thought Adam Lowry was excellent, as always, in the playoffs. And, you know, there were positives. Like, Tucker Poolman, I thought, was, you know, an absolute warrior in this series. Not just, you know, the block shot in the face, but, you know, he just, I thought, played really well on that third pair with Nathan Beaulieu. And obviously, you know, the third pair wasn't, you know, as big of a factor. But, yeah, you could go up and down the lineup, and you could look at that, you know, Backlund, Tkachuk, Mangiapane line, and you mm-hmm. could say, well, that line was, you know, probably the most dangerous line for the Flames. You could also say the Flames' top line was better than the Jets' top line. Like,
even Sam Bennett. I thought Sam Bennett was, tremendously impactful for the Flames in this series.
Absolutely, and we talked about that when we were previewing the series. He led the Flames in scoring against the Avalanche during last year's first round. So there are a lot of reasons why you could say the Jets lost this series, but I think, you know, in a situation like this where, you know, unfortunately you weren't able to force a 5-game and you weren't able to go to the round of 16, you kind of have to look at, you know, some of those positives, like Nikolaj Ehlers, you know, getting some goals, because really, if you take a team's top two players out of the roster, I mean, it's really tough to win a best-of-five series. It really is. And then you throw in some more injuries. Like, Mason Appleton, Dave mentioned this, you know, on Twitter, I saw, and, you know, people kind of forgot about Mason Appleton, but, you know, Mason Appleton was a big part of that fourth line, right? Like, the Jets essentially didn't have a threat out there on the fourth line, and their third line was depleted because other players had to move up in the roster, right? Kopp, Perreault. So it was just everything seemed to be going against the Jets. But, you know, I just wanted to mention that there are some positives, you know, in this series. And, you know, Jansen Harkins is right at the top of that list. Everybody saw, you know, what Paul Maurice said, you know, post-game. You know, no player received less than Jansen Harkins. They didn't even, you know, think that he was going to play in this series. And he ends up getting his first career playoff goal. So, you know, really unfortunate, you know, the way it ended, you know, getting outscored 10-2 in those last couple of games, getting, you know, shut out in the fourth game. But, you know, it was just really hard when you don't have your big guns like Scheifele and Lyonnais. You know, I think it's really tough, to win in a short game series. And Calgary played really well. You got to give Calgary, you know, credit. Having said all that, you know, the Jets are not going to use the injuries as excuses. But the Flames came to play. I mean, there was some pressure on the Flames.
The Flames were the better team.
Based on what happened last year against Colorado.
The Flames were definitely the better team, Dave.
You know, the only thing I was going to say, speaking to that injury situation, it's unbelievable, though, considering how the year went from an injury standpoint for the Winnipeg Jets, I think second only to Columbus, or in top five in terms of man games lost. And then we talked about it throughout training camp. The only guy who actually was injured in training camp, as far as we know, was Nikolaj Ehlers.
Sure.
And they looked like they were actually going to have their healthy unit. So you're thinking to yourself, okay, you're going to have a healthy Winnipeg Jets. I mean, that was so many of the articles. Finally, the Jets get to see what their healthy team looks like.
Yeah.
And then game one, you lose three guys, and you have to bring in three new guys for game two and start juggling. And to Tazzy's point, you lose Matthew Perreault, you lose Tucker Pullman. I mean, that's a lot of big losses.
Yeah, absolutely right. And just quickly before we go to break, and you talk about the injury, and we talked about, you know, the quote, you know, was Tkachuk's hit deliberate? You know, did he try and injure Scheifele? And the truth is, we probably won't know, and I suspect he probably didn't. But what I don't like is that everybody, hockey people, knowledgeable hockey people on Twitter, immediately discount the possibility of one player deliberately trying to injure another player, despite the fact that we have seen it time and time and time again in games where guys do things that can only be considered deliberate and at an attempt to injure an opponent.
Well, the Sam Bennett hit on Matthew Perreault was deliberate. That at the very least, Drew, that should have been probably a major penalty.
Well, he hit him perfectly in the numbers. Textbook.
Not a minor penalty. That was a major.
But so, I mean, immediately it's discounted. No hockey player would ever try and injure another hockey player. I'm like, I'm going to have to call BS on that because we've seen it happen.
So you're not talking about the specifics of this one, maybe, but you're saying...
I'm just in the general concept that no hockey player would deliberately try and injure an opponent.
Well, I mean,
we've seen it happen so many times. We know people, when we play, you know, rec league sports or rec league hockey, people who are mild-mannered, calm people off the ice or outside of the competition arena that completely lose their minds and become completely different people. They look like rabid dogs almost when they get into the heat of battle, even an insignificant battle like a rec league sport. So you can't tell me that professional players who oftentimes are wired even a little bit more intensely, that it's completely out of the realm of possibility that they try and injure one another. I mean, you see it time and time again. So did Matthew Tkachuk try and injure Mark Scheifele? Probably not. I'll give him the benefit of the doubt and say probably not. But at the same time, it's not impossible that he did, and it's not impossible for one hockey player to deliberately try and injure another
Fair
one.
Enough. I can't argue with that.
We see that's what drives me crazy, that every, you know, that the quote unquote experts online, hockey people, should know better than to immediately discount the possibility. I think they're doing a disservice to the reality of how people are wired in the course of a game.
I'll say this much really quickly, Drew. In real time, when you saw that it was Tkachuk and Scheifele going into the boards and the way Scheifele fell and the way he stayed on the ice, in real time, it looked like intent.
It looked like he lifted his skate and tried to get the back of his leg.
And I think it was really just Scheifele off balance. And because it was Tkachuk, we, you know, analyzed it and overanalyzed it and everything like that. But it was one of those plays where it was kind of, I think you would agree, it's almost kind of like that gray area.
It's certainly a gray area. So to immediately discount it and try and say a blanket statement that it never happens is a disservice to the fans. It's a disservice to the public. You can say it, you don't know. You can say it's a possibility. It doesn't make you a weak analyst to say I don't know or in that situation. Just say I don't know. We'll probably never know, but it is a possibility.
And the unfortunate thing is Scheifele doesn't come back. If Scheifele comes back, we're probably not talking about it. But because he didn't come back, the Jets lost the series. We're going to be talking about this for months to come.
When we come back, we're going to talk more about the Jets, of course. What needs to happen for the Jets to become an upper echelon team in the NHL. Two straight years with a first round or a qualification round exit. What do the Jets need to do to regain their status as an upper echelon team? You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Saturdays are for the Curve on your home of the Jets. TSN Radio 1290.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
You know, Mike, it starts from, from July 1st last year to August 6th. I've never had a team go through what this group's been through. I mean, loss of just key people and then the injuries on top of that. So I thought tonight looked like our season.
That's Jets head coach Paul Maurice after the game on Thursday night, lamenting the way of life that it's been for the Winnipeg Jets this season. Welcome back. Saturday morning, you're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We are live on TSN Radio 1290. Big shout out to all those who are tweeting us at Illegal Curve. You can also send your texts to 1290.90. Standard messaging rates, of course, do apply when you do that. Like our buddy Dallas, he's saying Saturday morning with Illegal Curve. It's going to be a great Saturday today. Thanks for listening, Dallas. We also want to hear from you, so be sure to join in on the conversation. We had the Illegal Curve question of the day, which ties in seamlessly with this segment. Should the Jets, so this is the IC Radio question of the day, should the Jets be considered an upper echelon NHL team? And if not, what needs to happen for them to regain that status? Send us your texts, 1290.90. Send us your tweets at Illegal Curve. We'll read them if they're good on air. So let me pose that question to you guys, gentlemen. Should the Jets be considered an upper echelon NHL team after two disappointing, I'll say, first-round playoff exits? And if not, what needs to happen for them to regain the lofty status that they had a couple years ago when they went all the way to the Western Conference Final, Dave?
Well, I mean, I would not consider the Jets to be an upper echelon team. I think they're more of a mid-tier squad in the NHL. Thankfully, with the parity that we see in the NHL, that doesn't really probably take that much to get to that next level. But, I mean, they're not in the same level to me as, like, a Tampa Bay or a Boston, those types of teams. So I think, you know, to your point, Drew, I mean, it's been the storyline all season long, but when you lose that many, you know, key pieces along your blue line, you know, it's going to take some time, and we've seen it, right? Like, you know, there's a lot of hope with Jets fans for the guys that are coming up, you know, the Dylan Sandbergs, the Villanolas, to really kind of augment that defensive unit that the Jets have. And I think that's really the biggest area of concern. I mean, look, you know, we've talked about it for a long time. Brian Little, his health is obviously a major, major question mark. I actually thought it was rather interesting. He really didn't get a lot of play because, of course, everybody's focusing on the play-in series. But Paul Maurice, when he was talking about Brian Little, mentioned the retirement word. Now, I hadn't heard Paul Maurice or Kevin Cheveldayoff or anybody use the word potentially retire. You know, when he was talking about the uncertainty surrounding Brian Little, and he mentioned that, you know, pause, that could include, that thought can include retirement. So to me, the big question obviously for the Jets is still going to be that 2C situation. What are they going to do? Because obviously with Mark Scheifele, you know who your 1C is going to be for the foreseeable future. And again, I don't have to go through the scoring, but the Jets have very good scoring. I mean, even if they didn't necessarily get it this series based on the reasons we outlined in the first segment.
Their top six wingers are pretty clear,
yeah,
and identifiable.
You can put them up against most teams and they'll be fine. I think, and even the depth, I think, actually is there, to be honest with you, with guys like Harkins, Appleton, you know, Kopp and Lowry. I think that you can kind of add some pieces here and there from within or sign through free agency, that could be fine. Like even a guy like Egan, to be honest with you, lower down in the lineup is probably not a bad situation. But again, to me, it's really your questions on defense. Who is going to really give you that security throughout the lineup? Because we know, especially with what we saw this year with the Jets, that depth is so important. So, you know, Sandberg, again, like I said, Heinola, those types of guys. And there's a laundry list of guys who really are, you know, the Gavankes, the Kovacevics. Those are the young guys who are with the Moose. Again, those guys will most likely be with the Moose again for the full season next year. But they're the guys you can kind of look towards that I think are going to really be what is important for this Jets team to kind of get back to that next level.
Well, let me just follow up on that, Dave, because I want to get you in, Ezzy, here. So you're talking about young guys, and particularly on the blue line, because that seems to be where the Jets have their most depth at this point in time. I mean, in terms of forwards that are at the AHL level, I mean, I mean Christian Vesalainen is probably a guy that the Jets still have high hopes for, but you know, who knows if he's a year away or 2 years away, whatever it might be. The problem that the Jets have, Ezzy, is that guys like Blake Wheeler are not getting any younger. I mean, you know, it's almost like your forwards are ready to strike now, but your defense is maybe lagging a little bit behind in terms of on the development curve.
Yeah, you know, Dave makes a lot of good points. You know, Dave went up the middle, and obviously Cody Eakin, Nick Shore, those guys are pending UFAs. We don't know if they're going to be back. I mean, Cody Eakin, you know, was making around, you know, $4 million, I think just under $3.8 million. So are you going to bring him back as your fourth-line center, obviously, because Adam Lowry's kind of penciled in there as your third-line center? And we know that, you know, the Cody Eakin at second-line center experiment didn't work in the playoffs. Like, it worked guys a little bit when he was acquired from Vegas, and you know, he had some chemistry with Patrick Laine and Nikolai Ehlers, but I think we all agree, and I really like Cody Eakin's game, I gotta say that, good Winnipeg boy, but I think he's better suited, you know, to be either a third line center or fourth line center, right? I think we'd all agree with that. So you have to address that second line center need. Like, that, to me, that's the biggest need.
We sound like a broken record.
Well, no, but I mean, that kind of, you know, wasn't an issue going into this season because you had Brian Little. And Dave mentions, you know, Brian Little, unfortunately, it looks like, you know, he might not be ready for the beginning of next season. We don't know long-term if his career is over. Like, that would be all speculation at this point. Mm-hmm. Like, we really just don't know. Obviously, we follow the team, you know, we're around the team to a certain degree, but we just don't know that. So that's the big question mark. Is Brian Little an option next year? If he's not, then who are you going to plot into that second-line center role? Like, is it going to be from within? Is it going to be a Jack Roslovic? Is it going to be an Andrew Kopp? Like, I don't know if those guys are the best options right now as a second-line center. Then you have to ask yourself, like, to me, you probably want to bring in at least one or two defensemen in your top six, right? Like, you're looking at that defense, and you're saying Neil Pionk, Dylan DeMello, if he's re-signed, and Tucker Pullman. That's your right side. I mean, it's obviously not as big and physical as it was when you had Trouba, Myers, and Dustin Byfuglien. But to me, like, I have no problem with that right side. Like, a lot of people think that the Jets really need to bring in either a top pair, second pair, right side guy. Like, to me, the big question mark is, with Josh Morrissey there, like, Josh Morrissey and Dylan DeMello, to me, I have no problem with that as your top pair. Is Ville Heinola going to slot in as your second pair left shot defenseman next year?
It's, I mean, too soon to tell.
Well, it's too soon to tell, but there's more likelihood of that happening than Dylan Sandberg. Mm-hmm. You can't pencil in, like, Dylan Sandberg is a guy that I think, you know, most people in the Jets organization think is going to have a long career in the NHL as a top four defenseman, but he's never played pro hockey. So with the AHL season starting in December, you got to think that there's a good chance Dylan Sandberg at the very least starts the season with the Moose, and maybe he gets a call up. But there's a good chance, Dave, that Sandberg spends the whole season in the American Hockey League. So you're talking about the 2021-22 season when Sandberg's really going to have an effect. So if you consider that, you wonder, you know, if the Jets maybe go after, you know, a left shot defenseman in the free agent market. And again, you know, Nathan Beaulieu, I think, did a fine job on the left side. But I mean, I just think the left side to me probably is where you want to make an acquisition on the Jets defense. But absolutely, the Jets have to address.
But I think it has to be more of an acquisition than simply, you know, sort of a 1 year free agent signing to fill a stopgap. That's not going to be good enough.
No, I'm talking about Dmitry Kulikov is a pending UFA.
Yes.
I don't know if the Jets are going to re-sign him. There's a chance they don't. I think the Jets need a top four left side defenseman. That's what I think the Jets need. And I agree. I don't think it should be a stopgap 1 or 2 year contract. I think they need to go out and they need to acquire a really good defenseman because Sandberg is a couple of years away, or at least a year away. And we don't know. This is the thing, guys. Ville Heinola surprised everybody and made the Jets at the beginning of the season. A lot of that had to do with the injuries and the turnover on defense. I just don't know if you can pencil him in as a top four defenseman right now. I would be much more comfortable if, you know, he starts the season on a third pair, plays, you know, 12 or 14 minutes a night. That's all I'm saying. And the question you asked, Drew, was, you know, what are the areas that the Jets need to improve next year? I think they're a long way away from an upper echelon team. I was actually going to say, you know, when Dave was mentioning, you know, Tampa Bay, St. Louis, Boston, I don't know if the idea of an upper echelon team exists anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and that's, I mean, probably upper echelon regular season teams exist, but then the playoffs, it becomes such a dogfight that you see the upsets happening. You see the Tampa Bay's losing to Columbus last year.
Look at Boston. Boston lost both of their round robin games, Drew.
Sure, but they lost those to other quote unquote upper echelon.
No, but
all I'm
saying is, like, you know, Boston was the one team that you thought going into the round robin, you know, they're the best team. They should win these games, but, you know, like you said, they're going up against other good teams. I'm just saying,
yeah.
I don't know how many upper echelon teams there are. There might be, you know, two or three, but even those teams can get knocked out in the first round of the playoffs.
When we come back, Murad Atesh of The Athletic is going to join us to talk more about the Jets. We want to hear from you, of course. Send us your text to 1290 and send us your tweets to @IllegalCurve. It's Saturday morning. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We are live on TSN Radio 1290.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show,
the podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Bottom of hour number one. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Saturday morning, we're live on TSN Radio 1290. Drew Mindell, Dave Minuke, Ezra Ginsberg with you. You can follow us on Twitter @IllegalCurve. And our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets news and audio is IllegalCurve.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show hotline.
From TheAthletic.com, he's a good friend of ours, a good friend of the program. We're pleased to welcome back Murad Atesh. Murad, good morning, and thanks so much for waking up bright and early with us.
Hey, good morning. It's not a bad way to start the day at all, is it?
We appreciate you saying that, because our wives certainly don't agree with you on that front, but that's a separate issue altogether, I think. Obviously, Murad brought you on to... Yeah, that's right. I guess whatever gets us here. You're right about that. You know, obviously brought John to talk about the disappointing end to the Jets season, losing in four games to the Calgary Flames. You know, if Scheifele and Laine are healthy, how different do you think this series looks than what we saw happen over the course of the last seven or so days?
Well, I think the tempting answer is to look at those star players and say, well, hey, if Winnipeg was very much in it without them and had a chance and certainly wasn't clear-cut the better team at all, but was in it, that maybe they would have pushed them over the top. And I think that we've all been robbed of the best version of the Winnipeg Jets after so much time waiting for those guys to play. At the same time, I look at the series as a case of freebies and a case of at least one free goal for the Calgary Flames every single game. And a lot of that comes from special teams. A lot of that comes from the penalty kill. Neither of Scheifele or Laine killed penalties, so that was going to be an issue one way or the other. You definitely missed them on the power play. My goodness, it looks at times like they didn't quite have a plan without their premier shooters, so that was definitely an issue. And at 5-on-5, to go without your number one center that entire time, I mean, Winnipeg was game. It did the best it could under the circumstances, but you have to think that he would have found a little bit of magic. Does it change the entire series? I don't know. I still think I had it as 50-50 with Connor Hellebuck stealing a game heading into the series, and Connor Hellebuck didn't steal a game, so I still think Calgary would be full value for what they've done.
Murad, I really enjoyed reading your article yesterday in The Athletic. Basically, you know, the headline was, you know, the Jets have been haunted by ghosts all year long, and we know what those ghosts are. Obviously, Dustin Byfuglien not playing is one of them. You also have a great part of that article talking about your conversation with Blake Wheeler and, you know, his desire to win the Stanley Cup there. And, you know, when you talk about one thing that you mentioned in there, the uncertainty of, you know, Brian Little being maybe the most worrisome thing, you know, that the Jets are going to have to deal with in the offseason. Is that something to you that maybe has to be at the top of Kevin Cheveldayoff's list, addressing that second line center need?
I think so, absolutely. And you've got your daily question. We can circle back to that. I'm not sure if you want to get into that, but I've been following along on the show and on Twitter so far. But I mean, let's talk about Winnipeg as a great team as recently as 2018, and what that team had was center depth. And even with a healthy Brian Little, who's a, you know, at this stage of his career, he's still a middle six center. I don't think he dominates in a second line role as much as he may have used to, or even a first line role as he used to. But a healthy Brian Little is a middle six center and can do a lot of different things. But even the team that has him healthy has added center help in Kevin Hayes and Paul Stastny at the deadline. And the thought that he was able to go through all of that time and try so hard and skate with the guys and do everything in his power to come back and then not be able to in time for the postseason, that begins to get the mind wondering and worrying about his long-term future. Certainly people have missed long times before and come back, and so I'm not saying that there's any guarantees here. But Winnipeg needs to proceed as if it needs a second-line center, and that's with or without Brian Little. And they don't grow on trees. It's a tough ask. I think that you saw what happened without Mark Scheifele. I mean, Andrew Kopp did a fine job, a really good job, and scored a couple of goals. Cody Eakin didn't he register a point. He had one shot in the series. The Jets needed help at that position on a team that wasn't good enough to make the first round of the playoffs. So if Winnipeg's goal, as it is to make it further than the first round of the playoffs, number two center is one of the biggest priorities on the club.
All right, we have to ask you about the coming out party for Nikolaj Ehlers. I mean, we're all big fans of what he is able to do on the ice, but just how important was this play-in series for his confidence and for what he's was able to accomplish for this team?
Yeah, Dave, I'm with you. It was very important, very, very important. And I'm of two minds that I feel like might sound contradictory, but don't contradict themselves as far as I'm concerned. One is that I don't think Nick Ehlers was ever going to be a problem. I think the reputation was bigger than the actual issue of Nick Ehlers' postseason play. Certainly there were times, you can find him if you watch the video of 2018 in particular, I would say, where it seems like he's figuring out his way through the physicality of the playoffs. But even that player moved the puck up ice really well and set up plays that then Paul Stastny or Patrick Laine eventually finished. And he was a young player, and there's lots of stories about young skilled players that take some time to get going. So I think the reputation was overblown, but at the exact same time, the reputation existed. And until the day that Nick Ehlers was going to score in these big games, it was going to be something that we talked about because it was real, and it was going to be something that wore on Nick Ehlers as a human being who cares very much about helping his teammates win. So I think it became something that he took with him and had to slay. It was a dragon he absolutely had to slay in terms of having the career that he wants. And now that he's done it, I think the reputation hopefully is gone. It's not really something that we have to deep dive too many years into the future. But for him personally, I do think that that's special. He is a scorer. We think of him in a lot of ways. I mean, that his zone entries for sure, his speed, a little bit of unpredictability. But he's also scored more goals per minute at 5-on-5 than Mark Scheifele, Patrick Laine, or Kyle Connor have over the last three seasons. And for a player like that not to score when it really counts, I'm sure it wore on him. So, yeah, couldn't be happier for him as a human being that he's broken out of that.
Rod, just to piggyback on your thoughts there and Dave's question, you know, looking at what Nikolaj Ehlers did, not just, you know, in the four games here against Calgary, but also, you know, his body of work over the last few years, do you think it might be time for the Jets to maybe, you know, shape their offense more around Nick Ehlers, get him more involved on the first power play and start to really acknowledge that he is the most dangerous offensive weapon that they have?
Honestly, I think that yes, that's the case. I mean, the way that a coach expresses how important he thinks his players are, or she thinks their players are, is ice time. And Nick Ehlers has been a second line player by ice time, and a little bit lower than that because Winnipeg's top power play takes so much of the average power play. So I think we're at the point where all of our eyes should tell us that against Calgary, there were very few players that were consistently creating and consistently generating, and Nick Ehlers was definitely one of them. And the thing is, that didn't come out of nowhere either. There were plenty of times, plenty of shorter stretches during this regular season where he was Winnipeg's most dangerous offensive player, and a really good two-way player, not necessarily because he dominates in his own zone, but because he moves the puck up ice so well. That's an important player, and that's a very good player entering the prime of his career at 24 years old. I absolutely think that given what he can do to defenses and given how dangerous he is, there's plenty of room for his ice time to ratchet up into the first-line territory.
Murat Atesh is our guest on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. You know Murat's work from theathletic.com. It's Saturday morning. You're listening to TSN Radio 1290. Murat, you mentioned the need for a second-line center, and this is a bit of a broken record conversation for the Winnipeg Jets. How do the Jets go and acquire that second-line center? You know, free agency is a hard sell to get, free agents with a lot of options here to Winnipeg. We know that's always been a bit of a difficulty. Is this the year clear that Kevin Cheveldayoff needs to make a trade and be active on the trade market in order to fill that hole, be it subtracting somebody from the active roster, subtracting somebody, one of the Jets prospects, or even maybe dealing what could be or what will be at the very least a top 10 first round pick after the lottery happens on Monday.
Well, like you say, it's an important need, and it's at the exact same time as being as important as it is, it's tough to fill. So, I mean, you start looking at in-house solutions. Is Brian Little going to get healthy? And even if he does, you know, is that enough? Can Andrew Copp become a number two center? I personally believe that he can, and I think that there's something there. But you also, up until this playoff series, you question his offense, and then all of a sudden he's been just sniping. So there's that. I don't think Jack Roslovic's ready to seize it. So then you start thinking about unrestricted free agents. And I don't think Cody Eakin is a top six impact center. So there, despite the relationship and despite the appreciation of a local guy so proud of Winnipeg there, I don't think he's a solution. You start going through the free agency lineup, like a Derek Brassard, who Winnipeg had interest in 2018, Alex Galchenyuk. There are players, all of these guys, you know, and you mentioned it can be tough for Winnipeg to really excel in the unrestricted free agent market because there's sunnier places to go and et cetera, all those things that get overhashed, but it can have truth to them. So the market, even then, a lot of these players have warts. I mean, Derek Brassard was a great player 2 or 3 years ago. He hasn't really pushed player-driven play in the time since. So Winnipeg may have done well to not successfully trade for him. You got a player in Michael Granlund whose season just ended with Nashville, who's a really strong two-way player, a little bit of mix between center and wing over the years, but has a combination of offense and two-way skill. But I think that's just one unrestricted free agent without a ton of warts that could step into that second-line role. And he's not a big guy, and I know there's lots of folks out there who will think that Winnipeg got pushed around and bullied this year, so that could be perhaps a question if that's your style of player. And then you get into the trade candidates. I mean, I know Max Domi has some issues in Montreal with quite how high up the depth chart he's able to get as center. He's not a perfect player either. I've looked at Roope Hintz, a friend of Patrick Laine's, who's kind of the Dallas Stars blooming, probably a second-line center at some point, but he's still developing. There's no guaranteed answer, I guess, is what I'm trying to say, despite going through all of the possibilities. How do you address it? And this is what you were suggesting. And Winnipeg has, they're going to have a high pick, and it's going to be top 10, could even be number one. So there's an asset there. But if you trade that after the Paul Stastny trade and after the Kevin Hayes trade, if you trade that now, I think Winnipeg absolutely needs an answer that comes back and lasts. It can't be a few month solution, because at some point, these young stars we talk about, like Kyle Connor, Nick Ehlers, Patrick Laine, et cetera, are going to be aging out, and Winnipeg's going to need replacements. And the pipeline isn't that deep right now when it comes to these impact players. And you've seen what happens when age hits a superstar. I think that Blake Wheeler a few years ago would have dominated a series like what we just saw. So, if you trade that pick, it's got to be a winner. The last thing I'll throw, and I know this is a long answer already, is last year there was smoke around a Nick Ehlers for a defenseman trade as Winnipeg was looking at its luxury of wingers and its clear needs on defense. And I wonder, in an unlikely scenario, if a similar winger for center trade might be in the future of the Winnipeg Jets. That would be a home run swing. It would be a big shift, whether it was Ehlers or Connor or Laine, none of whom I think Winnipeg would want to trade. I don't think that that's necessarily a reality. But that would be an example of swinging for the fences to get that player who's not on the unrestricted free agent market and who doesn't have nearly as many warts as the rest of the guys.
Rod, that answer was definitely not too long. You bring up some great points and options there. Roope Hintz is a guy I really like, and even Max Domi. You go back to that 2013 draft; he went right before Josh Morrissey, right? So I think that would make a lot of sense. Obviously, we're just throwing out names here, but I wanted to ask you about Jansen Harkins. I heard you on the Don Vito roundtable, talking about Harkins. Obviously, in Game 2, he gets the big goal. We didn't even know that. Didn't even know if he was going to be an option for the Jets here in the playoffs. But in your mind, is there any way that he doesn't play a full season with the Jets? Obviously, barring injury next year, but I think you'd agree that he proved that he should be an NHLer full time next season.
Oh, 100%. And you guys, you're all over the beat. You have the Moose covered. You saw his rise coming, and he is a special player who I absolutely believe in to be an NHL player. He's announced himself just by playing the right way in Winnipeg. And for me, what that means is you never question his hustle on the forecheck or the backcheck. He clearly has hand, the point per game player at the AHL level, an AHL all-star. Clearly, he's one of those guys that you see after practice staying on for more work, and that can be a bit of a cliche. If he's not a good player and he stays on for more work, what does it do? I'm not sure. But in the case of Jansen Hargan, he's a good player who is also doing the extra work after practice. I've tripped over him, or almost tripped over him, at least a few times in the dressing room after games when he's still stretching it out and doing exercises while the cameras are on Scheifele or Laine or some other star. The guy does all of the right things, and I've got a story up at The Athletic about the hill outside his home in North Vancouver that he does wind sprints on all day long in the summer times as well. The guy is driven, and I think that we all saw against Calgary that, you know, Winnipeg's bottom six did well predominantly, and guys like Jansen Harkins were the answer there, played so well. The one thing I'll say as well, if you project this team in the future and you're looking for that next, you know, Andrew Kopp with a little bit of offense, a little bit more offense, let's say, or a player who plays so hard in all situations that their game just seems to automatically translate to the playoffs. I really think that Jansen Harkins is one of those guys. I think Mason Appleton is another one of those guys as well. I don't think of them as elite scorers by any stretch, but I think of them, if they're your third line in a couple of years, I think that you could overpower teams, at least from the bottom six perspective, because they can do a little bit of everything and they do it the right way.
Well, Murat, I got to ask you, if we're projecting, let's project right till next season. Do you have Ville Heinola or Dylan Sandberg on the Jets' left side next season?
I think that at least one of them will play games. I don't know that I would project them to absolutely start the season, but I've been argued with plenty of times. And so my argument is this. Ville Heinola is still a very young player. He came in and impressed us all so much, and I've written glowing, glittering words about his play, his hockey IQ, his ability to read the play and make a pass faster than the rest of the players on the ice read the play, even at the NHL level in training camp last year. So I think the world of the player, but he didn't go to Finland and absolutely dominate there. And he's still developing in terms of his size, his strength, these other sorts of things. It may be that another year in Finland or a year in the AHL is what's best for his development. Because there's a hole on Winnipeg's top four, which turns into a hole in the bottom pairing as well. But if you're lining up with on Winnipeg's second pairing, pardon me, next season, you're going to do some heavy, heavy lifting against players like Tkachuk, Mangiapane, and Backlund, who just pushed Winnipeg around. I'm not necessarily convinced Tainel is ready for that. Meanwhile, Dylan Sandberg has been... he's a little bit more all around. He's got the size and the strength, can do a few more different things, though maybe perhaps not as absolutely brilliant as Heinola is, because I really hold Heinola in a top percent among NHLers in some sort of ways that way. There's a lot of cases of AHL experience for those college players. And, you know, it took Neil Pionk some time to really get his wings under him as an NHL player. It took Tucker Pullman some time to do the same. So I think that just tempering expectations for what that what that game one roster looks like, I think it would be more fair to these young guys to say that it's a bonus if they blow things out of the water and steal that spot. I think that it would be better for Winnipeg if they were able to get coverage at that position, whether it's a free agent signing or otherwise, without depending on them or counting on them or saying that they have to excel for Winnipeg to have success next year.
Murat Attash covers the Winnipeg Jets for TheAthletic.com. Murat, thanks so much for joining us this morning. Great insight, and of course, everyone should continue to read your work as you're going to be all over the Winnipeg Jets offseason going forward. Thanks so much, buddy.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
Our pleasure. When we come back, much more on the Jets. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We are live on TSN Radio 1290.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show,
the podcast,
on TSN1290.ca.
And we spent a lot of time coming off the bench going, man, this guy played great for us. A big, strong, mobile defenseman that developed later in his career. But boy, yes is the answer. Tucker was fantastic in this tournament. And I mean, that's a bullet hole to the face. Like, that's a cut straight through his cheek, and still blocking shots tonight.
Jets head coach Paul Maurice talking about the impact and the play of Tucker Poolman in the first round defeat to the Calgary Flames. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Saturday morning. We're live here on TSN Radio 1290. The segment brought to you by Dr. Les Rikus and the team at Linden Market Dental Center, official dentist of Illegal Curve Hockey. Don't be an Ezzy. Always wear a mouth guard and give yourself peace of mind protection as well as facial teeth and mouth protection. To make an appointment to get your teeth to team, visit LindenMarketDentalCenter.com.
You know who I thought of when Tucker Poolman, you know, took that puck to the face and then his face absolutely, you know, was swollen? Do you remember Ben Lovejoy when that happened to him? This is years ago, but it was the same kind of situation when his cheek was, you know, the size of, it looked like a softball, not a golf ball. But that's kind of who I thought, if you guys remember back in the day with defenseman Lovejoy.
Well, you know, Tucker Poolman, and you heard from Maurice there talking about how impactful Poolman was in the series. And, you know, I think, you know, obviously the result is not what the Jets wanted, but I think there is a level of comfort in the Jets knowing that, you know, with Tucker Poolman, they probably could have their right side third pairing defenseman for the next, you know, 5 to 10 years, let's assume. Let's assume that, you know, with everything else being equal and there's no, you know, catastrophic injuries or things of that nature, Poolman does seem like he can settle in on that right side third pairing physical defenseman.
And that's $775,000.
Well, I mean, he won't be at that for the next decade, certainly for next
two more years.
Yeah.
Well, and the thing I think his ceiling is higher than a third pairing defenseman. Like,
He has more in him still than third pairing?
Well, I mean, he starts the season off on the top pair with Josh Morrissey, right? And we realize that, you know, that pairing had their issues. And then obviously, you know, Dylan DeMello comes over from Ottawa and, you know, does an admirable job, a really good job on the top pair. And we know that, you know, at this stage in his career, maybe Tucker Poolman, you know, isn't a top four defenseman. But I absolutely think, and that's why I think what you said, you know, is a very good point, Drew, when you bring up, you know, you could pencil him in as your third pairing defenseman for, you know, years to come, because you have the ability to move him up.
Sure.
Like, if you put Tucker Poolman on your second pair, I have no issues with that. Like, Tucker Poolman is a very physically, and, you know, when you look at his skill set, he's a very sound player. You know what I mean? Like, he's a very smart hockey player. He's a guy, like, we saw in the exhibition, he popped in a goal. Like, Poolman is a guy, like, you go back to his UND years, guys, like, Tucker Poolman was a dominant defenseman in American college hockey. It's not like this guy was just like a defensive defenseman. Like, he was the captain. Like, he's a really good player. So, yes.
Plays him forward.
That's a good point.
I don't think the Jets want that scenario to come
into
fruition.
Actually,
it's kind of funny, too, that
the Moose had to use him one game as the forward.
Yeah, well, I'm saying I don't think in an ideal situation that's how they have to use him. But to your point, Ezzy, I see what you're saying is that, you know, he does have that ability to maybe even grow his game a bit or play higher in the lineup depending on scenarios.
And that's what you want in a third-pairing defenseman, right? You want a guy that, you know, if you do have injuries, and, you know, we talked about it earlier in the show, it seems like, you know, the Jets have, you know, had injuries at every single point of this season. So just saying, I think that, you know, he is a guy that could probably, you know, go as high as a second pairing role.
You want a guy in your third pair who is probably going to win those battles, you know, when he's on the ice, you know, against other teams' third or fourth lines, that he's going to be able to hold his own and maybe even win those shifts, and then has the ability to play up the lineup. And that's what you're saying. And I think that is Tucker Poolman. And right now, if the Jets just put him there on the right side third pair and are comfortable with that, I think the team is going to be, would be fine at that point in time. The question is with, you know, how do they, does DeMello re-sign? And if he doesn't, can Poolman be in that top four on the right side? And then, you know, there's extra questions that come as a result of that one, Dave.
Yeah, absolutely. But I mean, to your point, Drew, I think look, there's always going to be, heading into an off season and then looking forward to the next season, there's always going to be those question marks, those things that you have to get done, right? And so from Kevin Cheveldayoff's point of view, like, that we talked about it, you know, that the defense is an area potentially of strength, but, you know, Blake Wheeler isn't interested, and a lot of the older guys aren't interested in what's going to happen with this team. Like, it's funny, and Paul Maurice was asked about this in his post-game availability, about is there a silver lining about, you know, having a top pick? Well, maybe, you know, he'll think about it, you know, next year or whatever, but the point is, these guys don't want to think about 2-3 years down the line.
No.
You know, that's for the GM to think about, that's for fans to think about, but the fact is, and we've talked about this forever, players don't care about what's happening in the future. They want to know what's happening for them. They want to know, are we going to win next year, and what is going to help us get to that point. So that's what's important, and I think Pullman can be a part of helping the Jets get to that point.
When we come back, hour number two on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, we talk more about the Jets. Do they need to be maybe have a more physical presence with their forward group after what we saw the Flames do to the Jets on the physicality side of the game? You're listening to TSN Radio 1290. This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Mark finished kind of with a second opinion today. We don't think there's any Achilles damage, so he'll heal. Patrick sprained his hand, and it's his top hand on his stick, so he couldn't hold his stick. And Mason Appleton suffered a shoulder injury.
The injury rundown from Jets head coach Paul Maurice, that come Thursday night after, of course, the Jets were defeated at the hands of the Calgary Flames, ending their 2019-2020 NHL season. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Saturday morning, we're live with you here on TSN Radio 1290. Drew Mindell, Ezra Ginsberg, and Dave Minuk with you. This segment of the show brought to you by our good friends at Bernstein's Deli, official deli of Illegal Curve Hockey and home of the Illegal Curve Sandwich, located in the Cordon Village Mall. Bernstein's Deli has been Winnipeg's deli destination for nearly 30 years. For more information, find them on Facebook or at bernsteinsdeli.com. I should actually say over 30 years, not nearly 30 years. It has been well over 30 years at this point in time. So the Jets obviously lose in that the 3-1 series defeat to the hands of the Calgary Flames. What struck me the most about the series, or one of the biggest aspects of the series, is that the Flames were able to, what I'll describe as manhandle the Winnipeg Jets on the physical side of things. And maybe that's a bit of an overstatement, but I don't think it's a significant overstatement. I thought the Jets just looked like they couldn't handle a lot of Calgary's physicality, and that had a significant impact in the final results of the series, along with, of course, the injuries that the Jets suffered. So next year, going forward, do the Jets need to find a more physical edge, perhaps even to design a fourth line that can play a more physical element? Because right now, this Jets team certainly cannot be described as a physical team.
No, and you know that's why when you go back 3 or 4 years, or what was it, 5 years ago, when the Jets first made the playoffs against the Anaheim Ducks, right?
They hit everything.
Yeah, that was more of a physical team. Even in 2018, you know, when you had the likes of Dustin Byfuglien and Ben Sherratt on the back end. So, yeah, there's no doubt, Drew, that you know this is a less physical team, and there's no doubt for anybody who watched that series, guys, that the Calgary Flames were the more physical team, right? And you know, at the beginning of Game 4. Who did you see fight Milan Lucic right off the bat, right? It was Nathan Beaulieu and Milan Lucic. And, you know, that was a heavyweight versus a middleweight.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Lucic, say whatever you want about Lucic, and he is not a fast skater. Mm-hmm. You know, Lucic had an impact in that series, right? Not just with goals, but he had an impact in terms of, you know, what he was doing physically to the Jets defensemen and Jets forwards. He was noticeable out there.
When he doesn't have to play a back-and-forth skating game, so when the Flames can get against a team where they can grind it out down low, mm-hmm. then Milan Lucic can still be a presence because he is so big, because he is so strong. But he gets into a problem when it's a back-and-forth game. He just can't keep up anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So against the Jets, where the Flames were able to really grind down low, Lucic was certainly noticeable, certainly had an impact, and the Jets had no answer for him, his size and his physical being.
Right. Lucic had 4 points, and Connor and Wheeler combined had 2 points, right? Like, that's an issue.
Yeah.
But when we're talking about physicality, I mean, Sam Bennett is a guy that we identified, you know, early on before the series started, when we were previewing the series. Like, Bennett is a guy that obviously has never lived up to being, fourth overall pick. He's never lived up to that in terms of, you know, the goals and assists, but he's a guy that has an impact, and I'll take Sam Bennett on my third line any day of the week. Like, to me, that was a big difference between the Jets and the Flames. And again, you know, we could identify goaltending was better for Calgary. We could say, you know, the defense and the special teams were better for Calgary, Dave. We could say the first and second line were better for Calgary. I think you could really say that for the entire lineup. Obviously, without Scheifele, Laine, Appleton, that had a big impact on it. But there's no doubt, Drew, that at times it looked like the Flames were too much for the Jets to handle. And that's because when you get into the playoffs, it's a different style of hockey. You're right. There's a lot more grinding down low. The one-on-one battles seem to be, you know, magnified. And I think at times we know that the Jets, especially the right side of their defense, is a little bit smaller. Now, I'm not saying that, you know, Pionk, and I'm not saying that, you know, certain defensemen like Josh Morrissey, I thought Morrissey, you know, maybe didn't have his best series, but I didn't think he was bad either. Like, there were so many factors going against the Jets, like those miscues behind the net with Pionk and Hellebuck, or Dmitry Kulikov going for a skate, you know, in Game 3, and just having, who was Matthew Tkachuk alone in front of the net, right? So, I mean, the Jets, to me, just weren't good enough defensively. They weren't good enough on special teams, and the injuries did play a factor. To me, physicality wasn't a major factor, but for me, it was noticeable that the Flames at times were pushing the Jets around, absolutely.
So going into the offseason, where the Jets have a number of questions when it comes to their forward group up front, they have a lot of free agents, they have a lot of, you know, sort of holes to fill. Mm-hmm. Should it be a priority, Dave, for General Manager Kevin Cheveldayoff to go and try and acquire players who can give, you know, the Jets' fourth line a particular identity? Because we've seen that for the last, oh, gosh, however many years it's been at this point in time, the Jets' fourth line has always been a bit of a mix-and-match bag. It's been a bit of a mishmash of guys that they acquire, or guys that they sign on one-year deals, or guys who are on two-way contracts who come into the lineup. I mean, the Jets' fourth line was, you know, might as well not have existed. So should it be a priority for Kevin Cheveldayoff to try and sign a fourth line or guys on a fourth line who can say, this is your identity? I mean, as you talk about the Islanders' Martin Clutterbuck line all the time.
Cizikas.
They have an identity. You know what you're going to get out of them. Is it time for, you know, Kevin Cheveldayoff to try and adopt something similar for the Jets' fourth line?
You know what? Yes, I would say probably it's a good idea, Drew. I mean, we've talked about how in an ideal world like that, Lowry would be in, you know, the old conventional wisdom, right? Your fourth line is your shutdown kind of thing, and third would still be a scoring line. So would Lowry really be well-suited for that? Because he's not going to score 20, 30 goals, you know, and ideally that's what, you know, that class of 2015 line was kind of setting itself up to be a good third line, and then you'd have that Lowry kind of be that identity, Lowry, Kopp, and even Perreault, depending on what happens with Pro, you know, that was kind of your ideal. Now, to me, your other issues are probably outweighing everything, like we said, second-line center, issues on defense. I think, you know, identity of a fourth line is important. I think also it depends on how the coach is going to play them. Mm-hmm. So I think all of those things definitely factor in. But I do think it's interesting how it's finally kind of dawned on the rest of the league, because obviously I, you know, aggregate all the news every morning. And for years, after the Jets weren't the same physical team that they had been,
they had the reputation.
They still had the reputation. So, you know, people writing about this big physical Jets team, I thought to myself, what team are they talking about? Are they not watching this Jets team?
And
you realize they aren't.
Yeah.
But, you know, and it finally kind of came up when I saw the Flames media were doing articles, and they were saying this isn't the same team as previously. And so, you know, that's definitely an element. But again, like I said, I think from within, you have the makings, again, depending on trust, right? If you want to trust, you know, your younger guys, right? Your that class of 2015. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you've got a guy in David Gustafson who's a very capable, you know, centered, very, very, you know, he's a strong kid. I mean, he's 19 years old, and he's like a monster. He's 20 now, sorry. But he's like physically, he's like a monster, that kid. And so, you know, and he's learned the game at the AHL level, and he obviously got some games in at the NHL level. So you've got some options from within, I think, to augment that in that role. And again, depends on what the coach does. I personally like that Lowry line as your fourth line. I like the class 2015 as your third line. Fill in that, you know, Brian Little, if you want, as your second line center. Figure that out. And then, again, like I said, then you can kind of mix and match. But to me, it's not a huge need. It's not as big a need to me as figuring out what you're going to do on your left side of your defense, even obviously your right side of your defense, because you don't have guys signed. So,
when we come back, Marty Biron is going to join us. We'll talk about some of the goaltending performances we've seen throughout the playoffs. Talk about Marty with everything that you've seen happen so far in the round robin and the qualification round. That's coming up next. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We are live on your home of the Jets, TSN Radio 1290.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show,
the podcast
on TSN 1290.ca.
Saturday morning, welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We are live here on TSN Radio 1290. Drew Mandel, Dave Minuk, Ezra Ginsberg. We want to hear from you. Send us your tweets at Illegal Curve. Send us your text to 129090. Standard messaging rates do apply. And our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets news and audio is IllegalCurve.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
We're pleased to welcome back to the program our good friend. You know him from his work with TSN, from RDS and MSG. Our good friend Marty Biron is joining us on the line. Marty, how are you? Nice to speak with you this morning.
Thank you, guys. It was a crazy day of hockey yesterday, but I am recovered this morning and ready for some more. So I'm doing good. Thank you.
That's good that you recovered. It really was a crazy day, and we'll get into a lot of what we saw yesterday. But first, we want to take you back to Thursday night, where the Jets were defeated by the Calgary Flames, losing the series 3-1, losing on Thursday night by a 4-0 margin. You know, how surprised were you with the performance of Cam Talbot in the course of that series for the Calgary Flames? I think that at the beginning of the series, if you had said that Cam Talbot was going to outplay Connor Hellebuck, most people would have thought that you were maybe drinking a little bit of the funny juice ahead of that.
Yeah, drinking the Kool-Aid maybe. But I got to talk to Cam Talbot this season, and I know Cam from our days with the New York Rangers. When I retired, he slid into my spot with the Rangers, and, you know, I talked to him a lot over the years, but I got to spend about 10 minutes with him last year in the Calgary Flames locker room, and he felt like his game was coming around. He felt like he had made some changes. The change of scenery with the Flames was good. The way the team was playing in front of him, it helped him. He had made some equipment change. He had gone from wearing the CCM equipment before to now the Bauer. And he really liked that. He thought it was light and really sliding pretty fast. So anyway, he had made some changes. He felt his game was coming around. But if you had asked me before the playoffs, I thought David Rittich, in my opinion, probably was going to be the Flames starter. I was surprised when Cam Talbot got the start in the exhibition game and also in game one. But you know what? The Flames obviously thought that he was giving them the maybe the stability that they needed. They knew that the Jets had some issues defensively, so if they could just not lose a game, not have a goalie give up a bad goal and take some of the momentum away, that they may be able to squeak by the Jets. And they went with Cam, and he was really good. I was really happy for him to see that, because as a goalie, when things start not going well and you start moving around, it's not easy to recover from that. And he did that in this qualifying round. That was great.
Marty, I don't think 15 minutes is going to be enough to have you on here with all the series that we have to talk about and all the goalies we have to talk about. We have to ask you about Carey Price and Corey Crawford and Jacob Markstrom. But I wanted to start off asking you about Elvis Merzlikins, because, you know, obviously, you know, Toronto has that incredible, you know, third period comeback, and Austin Matthews scores the big goal in overtime. But prior to that, Merzlikins came in relief of Jonas Korpisalo, who obviously let in those three goals in game three. But what did you see out of Merzlikins there late in the period? Because obviously Toronto had the push there, but, you know, prior to that, he looked so cool and calm, and, you know, the Leafs couldn't solve him. And then they, you know, they managed to solve him, you know, four times within the span of about an hour.
He was so good, and nothing seemed to faze him. Number one, he's extremely fast. Watch his movements and his recovery. The way he slides, his edge work is incredible. But I really think there comes a time where I say play goalie, it's like Kevin Costner's character in For Love of the Game, is you clear the mechanism, right? You slow things down, and there's nothing that fazes you. Well, it seems to me like the clearing the mechanism in the last 4 minutes wasn't working, because it seemed like everything was fast. He let pucks go through him. He wasn't as comfortable in the crease, and there's a few different reasons for that. One is that, you know, it's his first experience in that type of scenario, closing out a playoff, his first playoff start, and Toronto came out hard, so you got to give credit to Toronto. But also, Columbus seemed to back into him. They were right on top of him. They were backing into his crease. You know, so for him to feel comfortable in that setting, in that situation, really was difficult, because he didn't have the room to move. And and to feel at ease. So, I mean, John Tortorella's got a really big decision to make. Before game four, I thought if Elvis doesn't win this game, he goes back to Corpusello in game five. But the way the game happened, and Elvis Merzlikens was so good in just the last few minutes, and then the overtime power play goal, I would almost go back with Merzlikens because he had Toronto in the ropes for 56 minutes of that game. So I think I may go back to Merzlikens if I'm Torts.
Now, Marty, it looks like some people owe the Pittsburgh Penguins some apologies because the Penguins were rightly concerned about what Carey Price could do to their playoff aspirations. And what did you see from Carey Price and the Montreal Canadiens that allowed them to get that done?
I think Carey Price had a lot of energy. You know, Carey Price has always been a really strong starter of seasons. So when he goes away for the offseason, he can refresh physically and mentally, and then he starts really strong. Now, the problem with Carey Price is he's a big boy. I mean, he's, you know, not 6'1", 180 pounds. He's well over 200 pounds, and he's pushing 6'4", I believe, 6'3", 6'4". So he's a big man. And playing 65, 70 games in a season and dealing with injuries and little ailments and the second half sometimes or getting to the playoffs, he doesn't have the same level of energy as he did at the start of the season. Well, now 4 months off, coming into this new playoff season, and he had a lot of energy. His movements were great. He wasn't – sometimes we talk about lethargic-looking Carey Price, and if you want to know the exact way I look at it, I thought Connor Hellebuck looked lethargic in net for the Winnipeg Jets. Like, when he was down, he stayed down. He didn't have that urgency in his game, and the urgency was there for Carey Price, and that's the big difference, and that's why I thought Carey Price could win one game, maybe two. But I really didn't think Montreal had it to beat Pittsburgh because I didn't think Carey Price could find that energy level to be able to sustain the level at what he played. And he did, and it was good for the Montreal Canadiens.
Marty Biron is our guest on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Marty, you mentioned that you thought Connor Hellebuck looked a little bit lethargic. You know, is that a function of the long layoff and then immediately having to try and come back and be in sort of playoff form, or is there something else that you know in existence there when you see a goalie that maybe isn't at the peak of their game right to start?
I think Connor Hellebuck likes to rely on the structure a lot, saying I'm in good position, I'm a big goalie, the structure is going to carry me in having success, and that may be true when you play a full 82-game season, because you have to rely on that structure and the fact that, you know, you're covering your angles and taking the net away from the shooters. But I think when things go fast and there's rebounds and there's puck movement, you have to also find that extra gear. And he wasn't able to find that extra gear. Now, was he the reason the Jets lost? He was one of the reasons, but there was other reasons. I mean, losing Scheifele, Laine Appleton was one of them. Their special teams were not good enough. Their 5-on-5 play was not good enough. The Jets couldn't defend in front of Hellebuck. Everything around the net, they just couldn't defend in front of them. So there was like 4, 5, 6 reasons why the Jets lost. It wasn't just one of them, but obviously I think it usually starts in net, and you want to have that stability, and it just wasn't there.
Marty Biron is our guest on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. You're listening to TSN Radio 1290. Marty, another one of the upsets, another one of the 5-12 upsets sees the Edmonton Oilers and Connor McDavid and Leon Draisaitl go home and the Chicago Blackhawks move on. If you're the Oilers, is getting a true number one goaltender your number one offseason priority? It seems like both Koskinen and Mike Smith are not up for the job certainly any longer.
Yeah, I mean, I like to think there's example throughout the history of the National Hockey League, and we think of Michael Layton, Brian Boucher, Antti Niemi, Cam Ward. There's plenty of example of goaltenders that are able to outplay themselves when it comes to playoffs, and it doesn't have to be the $7-8 million goalie to win you games. With the Edmonton Oilers, yeah, with Koskinen, great. No, but I think he was good enough for them to win. I think there was some flaw in the Edmonton Oilers game. And you look at Chicago will themselves to win. Jonathan Toews will the Chicago Blackhawks to win with his blocking shots, his stick work, his physicality. I mean, that's what the captain did. And I look at the way that the Oilers played. I look at Draisaitl and Connor McDavid, and they're fantastic hockey player, and I would take him on my team any day of the week and twice on Sunday. But, you know, getting out of the shot lane, not being strong in the puck, losing your men in the defensive zone, that can't happen in the playoffs. And I think Chicago really taught a good lesson to the Oilers. It's not just about goaltending, but it was a part of it, but there was other lessons that the Oilers needed to take out of that.
Marty, I wanted to ask you about Jacob Markstrom because obviously, you know, he had the shutout for the Canucks in Game 3. Game 1, he was superb. And then yesterday, he seemed very uncharacteristically, sloppy at times. And I think of that Eric Staal goal. I believe that was Minnesota's second goal. And obviously, you know, it was a nice shot by Staal, but it seemed like, you know, Markstrom was struggling, especially near the post. You know, as a goaltender, what did you see out of Jacob Markstrom yesterday? Because obviously the Canucks get the win and they're going to advance to the first round of the playoffs. But is that just maybe a blip on the radar as far as Markstrom goes? Because obviously, as I mentioned, he was really good, you know, for the rest of the series.
Yeah, I think with Markstrom is that he's still searching for his identity as a goalie. Is he an athletic goalie that can scramble and with his size make saves? Is he a structured goalie that is playing well defensively, structurally, like positionally? Does he read the play good or not? Like, I thought yesterday his reads were awful. Like, he almost was surprised by some of the plays that the Minnesota Wild did. His positioning wasn't great. I really thought yesterday was not a good performance by Jacob Markstrom, but he is a good goaltender. And, that's what the Canucks are. Like, they have a lot of good players that can overcome that. And we've seen it, as I mentioned, like the Chicago Blackhawks, when they won the Cup in 2010, Antti Niemi wasn't great, but they had enough to be able to overcome maybe a missed game by the goaltender. And I think the Vancouver Canucks are good, and they're good enough that sometimes if Markstrom doesn't play well, they'll be able to win a game in that scenario regardless.
Now, Marty, we're a Manitoba-based show, so we're contractually obligated to ask about Manitoba goaltenders. So I'll ask you about James Reimer from Morwena, Manitoba. It went 7 years between his last playoff start and this one. But how special was it for him to get that win with Carolina?
You know what? James Reimer is such a nice guy. And, you know, having a chance to talk to him, play against him, you want to pull for him. He's had his struggles, obviously, and I don't think he's the type of goalie that will be a number one goaltender all by himself. But in a sharing net situation, I think he's really good. I was surprised Carolina went with Reimer in Game 3 because I'm thinking this is the best of five series, right? So if you give the Rangers a life and you give them a win, and they have Shesterkin in net, and he steals Game 4. And now you're Game 5, and you're scrambling. So I was really surprised. But, you know, Rod Brind'Amour, again, really finding a way to put that team together and say, we are a team. It's back-to-back. I have a plan in mind. I want Reimer to start. And he was unbelievable. He made some fantastic saves. And I was really happy for him and happy for the Canes. And I was sad to see my Rangers go because, I still really like the people in New York and my time with the organization, but the Carolina Hurricanes were too good for the Rangers, and it didn't matter if it was Mrazek or Reimer, they were both excellent, and James Reimer clinched it, and that was great.
Marty Biron covers the NHL for MSG. You know him, of course, as an analyst on TSN and RDS as well. Marty, thanks so much for your time and insight. We'll let you get back to your Saturday morning. Always appreciate it.
Absolutely, guys. Enjoy.
Thanks, Marty. Take care. When we come back, we look at some of the other Western Conference qualification round series. The Oilers are going home. The Predators are going home. Are changes afoot for both of those teams? You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Saturdays are for the Curve on your home of the Jets. TSN Radio, 1290.